everyone. Welcome to the Janet Foster Show for another edition of News, Entertainment, and Politics. We are coming to you live from Los Angeles, downtown Los Angeles, and it's pretty hot here today. And also, our show's going to be hot today. We're going to talk about a hot topic that's going on right now, basically in here in the Western Hemisphere. And it's all about Haiti today and the other part of the island, the Dominican Republic, known as Hispaniola. Both countries share an island. And today we have a guest from the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. We have Mr. Stephen Forrester, who is the Immigration Policy Coordinator. And we're going to talk all things Haiti today. Mr. Forrester, how are you doing today?
How are you? Thanks for the invitation.
You are so welcome, and I'm so pleased that you are joining us today. Especially here on the West Coast, we tend to not get very much information about the Caribbean in general in our news. So one of the efforts as a journalist that I'm trying to make available for the public is a lot of discussion on what's going on in the Caribbean and the East Coast. So I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us today. And
sure, my pleasure.
We're going to get right into it. One of the things that I wanted to ask you about, if you could share with our audience, the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, can you tell us about your organization and how it was established?
Yeah, the executive director of the organization, which is a nonprofit based in Boston, I'd welcome anyone checking us out by Googling IJDH for Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. It's a nonprofit, fairly small. The executive director is Brian Concannon, who has a lot of background in Haiti. Because of the history of dictatorships, the Duvaliers, et cetera, in that country, there's been a tremendous need to fight for justice for Haitians in Haiti. So he created this organization. I'm not sure. I think it's 15 years. I may be wrong about that. It's based in Boston. I work actually from Miami. My own background is immigration advocacy for immigrants from Haiti who've always historically been discriminated against. But I am really, really proud and delighted this last 5 or 6 years now. I've been on board at IJDH because of the really fine work they do. And just to name some subject matters, the earthquake that hit Haiti happened on January 12th of 2010. And what people may know a little less about is that in October of 2010, a cholera epidemic broke out. Cholera came to Haiti for the first time in 100 years. There had not been any. And it was traced back to United Nations peacekeeping troops from Nepal who were in Haiti and who, of course, inadvertently, through lack of proper sanitation procedures, introduced cholera into Haiti. I mention this because to date, the epidemic is still ongoing. Something like 7,000 or 8,000 people have died. Hundreds of thousands, 730,000 or so, are sick. And scientifically, nobody disputes that it was the United Nations troops that introduced it. I mention this because IJDH, the organization I'm with, has sued the United Nations in U.S. federal court. The case is now on appeal. And is trying to get the United Nations to be accountable to the hundreds of thousands of cholera victims in Haiti for this epidemic to introduce water and sanitation and to provide a mechanism under which the claims can be made by the victims. So that's just one thing that IJDH has been leading the fight on. Another is that when the dictator Duvalier returned to Haiti, he has since died, but a number of years ago, the affiliate organization of IJDH, it works very closely with a Port-au-Prince, Haiti-based human rights group led by a heroic human rights attorney in Haiti named Mario Joseph.
Yes.
And a small group of people, the Bureau des Avocats Internationaux, the Bureau of International Lawyers, they sued Duvalier on behalf of the victims.
Oh, excellent.
Another issue is elections, et cetera.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you for bringing that up. I definitely wanted to talk about the cholera epidemic for sure. And thank you for sharing that. And I think it is well known that the UN did have a significant role in the epidemic. And based on your organization's kind of work on the ground with some of your folks that and some of your activists that you have on the ground, has the UN at least made an apology or took some kind of accountability for their role in the cholera epidemic?
Well, that's the really disgraceful thing.
Wow.
They have not acknowledged responsibility, and they're hiding behind a legal fiction of immunity.
How?
So in addition to the legal effort, we have a very strong advocacy effort. So just as an example, last month on July 8th, a letter was sent from the Haitian American diaspora in 11 states, different states in the United States, and then a 12th group of organizations and individuals from Montreal, Canada. 154 Haitian American diaspora leaders, 65 organizations, and 89 additional political, religious, and other leaders sent a letter to United Nations Secretary General Ban and to U.S. Secretary of State Kerry, expressing, as they put it, deep outrage at the UN's complete failure nearly 5 years now after the cholera outbreak in Haiti that its troops introduced, that they haven't stepped up to the plate. It's a waterborne disease. They need to do much, much more in terms of water and sanitation systems. And under the agreement with the country of Haiti that the UN has that permits UN peacekeepers to be there, there is a mechanism that either side can invoke that would provide for a mechanism for the hundreds of thousands of victims to submit claims.
Okay.
And it's a real embarrassment even to former UN officials. Some prominent people have said the UN really needs to step up here. And it hasn't.
Oh, wow. And you know, one of the... I saw the reports from the U.S. Centers for Disease and Control, and there's been an estimate that basically every week that there's an average of more than 600 people a week are becoming infected with cholera on the island a week. And the U.N., it sounds like the U.N. is just not... They're not doing what they were meant to do, and that's to unite nations, it sounds like. And in terms of
just the other day, I think it was maybe 3 or 4 days ago now, was it last Thursday? The Boston Globe did a very strong editorial on this issue, saying the UN must step up, apologize, and drive cholera from Haiti,
yes,
getting into all of this. 77 members of the United States House of Representatives last December 18th sent a strong letter to the UN Secretary General. So this is very much an issue that is not at all academic because, as you say, people are still getting infected, dying, and there's just a tremendous need for the UN, as the Boston Globe editorial board said less than a week ago, to three, 4 days ago, to step up and apologize and drive cholera from Haiti.
Yeah, and you spoke also about claims, some of the claims that what your group is working to try to facilitate the ability for the people of Haiti to be able to file claims. I'm assuming that these types of claims would be financial in terms of lost, whatever that's involved. And also, with epidemics, there's the thought that there may be orphans, children orphaned if they've lost family members, specifically parents or even grandparents, and those kinds of things. Are those some of the remediation that you're looking to try to correct?
Well, it's a question of going from very little to something.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that the epidemic continues means not enough's being done. The responsibility scientifically has clearly been shown. Cholera had not existed for 100 years before October 2010. So the details remain to be determined, but what's essential is, and everybody agrees on this, that the UN needs to step up and do much, much more than it's been doing. And that's the basic fact that we have to deal with and come to grips with here. Certainly there'd be there should be some mechanism for people whose lives have been destroyed, devastated, severely impeded, to have some means of having some recompense.
Absolutely.
In addition to that, of course, there's the need for the water and sanitation systems to make sure that the epidemic is controlled and is contained, which is not yet the case.
Oh, wow. And in terms of if there are, I think, if there are groups or individuals, because we have a lot of activists in our audience, our listening audience, if they want to specifically get involved, and I do have a lot of medical personnel that I actually have some of our listeners who have actually gone over to Haiti just on their own as physicians and have administered. Are there some other things that maybe folks can do to get involved?
So very, very much so. I would urge people to visit our website. I've been doing, I'm an immigration advocate. I'm the one person on staff who deals with getting fair treatment for immigrants from Haiti. And so just to digress very briefly, after the earthquake, one of the things that IJDH led the effort on, this was my focus, was trying to get the Obama administration to speed up bringing into the United States Haitians in Haiti who our U.S. State Department and Justice Department, these people had already been approved to join their relatives here.
Right. They were filing immigration. They were in the process, the legal process.
Right.
Got it.
That's right. They were in the process, and they were on waiting lists of anywhere from 2 to 12 years. And right after the earthquake, people were saying, how can we help Haiti recover? Obama said, we're going to lead in helping Haiti recover. And a lot of commentators, even a leading Republican, said, look, if you want to help Haiti recover, speed up legal, not illegal, speed up legal immigration so that these people who we've already approved but may be waiting anywhere from 2 to 12 years, bring them in more quickly.
Right.
So one thing we did was we led an effort, again, working with Haitian Americans and others throughout the United States, getting editorials and all kinds of things, saying that our administration should create a Haitian family reunification program. And one of the things, one of the glaring things was there has been in existence since 2007, I think it is, a Cuban family reunification program that speeds up the process.
Yes.
For similarly situated Cubans.
Mm-hmm.
Make a long story short, last October, the Obama administration announced that even though on a much more limited scale than we would like, it was going to create, and it did in March of this year, a Haitian family reunification program. It doesn't cover nearly as many people as we'd like. It has some problems with it, but at least it exists. But to get back to your question as to how people can assist, I mention that because in a fairly long career now, I'm really proud to be associated with this group. IJDH consists of really superb people focused on the justice and democracy issues in Haiti itself.
Yes.
And anyone visiting our website, IJDH, can find a wealth of information. For example, we have a cholera accountability section where you can find the letters that I've referred to by the 77 members of the U.S. House of Representatives last December, or last month's letter from 154 Haitian American leaders urging U.N. accountability. And all of the work we're doing is there. And also, if anybody wants to contact me, I'd be delighted to refer them to the appropriate person in Boston with IJDH if they'd be interested. And my name is Steve Forrester. My email is real simple, steveforrester@aol.com.
Definitely. Definitely.
Forrester with one R. And one of the other things that we haven't gotten to yet, I think you want to get to it, I believe we have a very good page on our website that deals with the ongoing crisis right now. It's been very, taken a lot of attention in the Dominican Republic. It's the Dominican Republic citizenship crisis.
Yes.
If you Google IJDH Dominican Republic, you'll come up with a page in which hundreds of articles are listed, events that are ongoing about the crisis that's going on there now.
Yeah, and you know what? I do want to switch gears, but before we get into discussing the Dominican Republic, I wanted to also, you brought up something interesting for our audience here, which is largely made up of members of Generation X and the millennials. We do have a lot of cool baby boomers that hang out with us, but most of us who are Gen Xers and millennials, a lot of us, well, definitely the millennials, they weren't around to hear a lot of the positive things that were that was happening in Haiti in terms of when it flourished before Duvalier kind of did his thing. And Gen Xers like myself, we've heard the stories of how successful Haiti was. And then, of course, during our adolescence and in our college times, specifically in the 90s, we know about Jean Bertrand Aristide. Can you kind of talk to us about some of the work that your group has kind of been involved with in terms of trying to restore some kind of democracy in Haiti and kind of to address small things like voting? I mean, it seems as if it is so difficult to vote. And I am a former Miami resident. And one of the things that I remember a lot, even in the local news or and even talking to some of my friends whose aunts and uncles were very involved in the Haitian community about getting information to the island. There were also foreign nationals working in the U.S. that were trying to get their ballot information back to Haiti. Can you just share with us just some thoughts or insights about how your group has been working towards that?
Well, the history of Haiti is a fascinating one, and it led a successful revolt of slaves against the French, and in 1804 was the first Black Republic, and the freeing of the slaves was felt by slave owners in the U.S. South to be a real threat. So there's a long history. Then, unfortunately, from about 1957, I think it was, when Francois Papadoc Duvalier took over and created a paramilitary force, the Tonton Macoutes, directly loyal to him, to offset the power in Haiti of the military, which prior to Duvalier had sort of been the kingmaker. And then under his son, Baby Doc Duvalier, from 71 to 86, the dictatorship and the repression of the Macoutes continued, and there were a series of dictators. Until in, I think it was December of 90, for the first time, an election was held in which a charismatic former priest, he was still a priest at the time, I believe, Jean-Bertrand Aristide,
yes,
to whom you refer, ran. And for a brief period of 7 or 8 months, he was inaugurated, I think, February 7th of 91. And there was a tremendous outpouring in Haiti at that time of young people joining community groups and putting up Aristide's picture all over. He was sort of a Kennedy-like figure in terms of charisma.
Yes.
And so the military, when it, on September 30th of 91, just 7 or 8 months later, overthrew him, it knew exactly who was who, because people had come out of the woodwork to enjoy their democratic rights and organize. And thousands of people were killed in the next few years. Then under Clinton in 94, there was a restoration of Aristide, but the Republicans in the U.S. demonized him. And after an interim president, when Aristide was back, he was ousted again in 2004. And for a long time, the main party in Haiti, the main grouping, it's a little complicated, but basically the most popular groupings weren't allowed even to run. It was as if we'd have an election in this country and neither Republicans nor Democrats were allowed to participate. I mean, it would be a farce.
Right.
And so that was the case for a long time. Just last Sunday, a week ago, an election was held, and I'm no expert on this, but there were irregularities, but at least technically anyone was allowed to run, but there were some irregularities. So that's the first stage of some other elections going to be happening in the next, or scheduled anyway, for the next few months, but we'll see what happens. The main thing that our group tries to do is, from the very beginning, when Brian Kincannon founded the Institute, IJDH, I think in the 90s, I wasn't on board at the time, I should know this, I think it was the 90s, he partnered with Mario Joseph in Haiti,
yes.
Haiti's leading human rights attorney. And so there's a close relationship with the BAI, as it's called, the Bureau des Avocats Internationaux, the Bureau of International Lawyers. And the primary thing that they're involved with in Haiti is trying to strengthen the rule of law. So Mario is a real hero, and I say that because it's one thing to work for, you know, progressive causes in the United States, but to do so in Haiti, your life is at stake.
Right.
And always has been. So he's really not only an excellent attorney, but a tremendous man of courage. But what I want to say is, whether it's challenging certain massacres that occurred in court, past massacres, or things that are going on today, they bring things to the Haitian courts in attempt not only to seek justice for rape victims or others,
yes,
but to establish principles of the rule of law so that the court system itself is strengthened. And there are people who go over there and assist, because it's actually very exciting work, whether it's done in Boston or in Port-au-Prince. It's a long-term effort to create and strengthen structures of democracy and the rule of law and the court system.
Oh, thank you so much for giving us that history and that walkthrough. And incidentally, in addition to how successful the slave revolt was to establish Haiti, and this is a kind of a great segue into some other work that your group has been doing that's been outstanding. The Haitians, the slaves that basically ran off the French and established themselves, they also helped with liberating what is now known as the Dominican Republic. And since they're sharing that island, one of the hottest issues right now on that island is the citizenship crisis of Dominican-borns, meaning they were born in the Dominican Republic, but they are of Haitian descent. And how we're getting information here in the media is that basically back in, I think it was 2013, the Dominican government came up with this law. And it was ratified by the government that citizenship would no longer be given to people automatically born in that country, or that certain immigrant groups, their citizenship was stripped all the way back to 1929. That is very concerning, definitely for journalists, how we're getting that information. Unfortunately, through a lot of the channels, a lot of us who are journalists, we're getting dribs and drabs. And then the kind of information that we're getting from the Dominican Republic is very, I'll just go ahead and say it. The kind of information I've been getting has been very controlled, very pat, it's something's just not right about it. And as a reporter, I feel like something in my gut is telling me that we're here in the Western Hemisphere, something really wrong is going on. And second, from a consumer perspective, I almost feel sick about it. And I know some of our listeners have emailed and have also posted on social media with me asking me different questions. And what I'd like to get into is kind of some of the nitty-gritty of the work that your organization has been doing, and kind of some of the information from your activists who are on the ground close to this issue, because how we're getting it is that there are people who were born in the Dominican Republic. They know nothing of Haiti. They only speak Spanish. They don't speak French. Their surnames might be French, but they are Dominican, but they're being kicked out, or they're rendered stateless. That's sort of what we're getting in the media. And in terms of the work of your organization, I know you guys have really been very active. Can you share with my audience some of the things that you guys have been doing?
We have been active, but so have all kinds of Haitian-American groups and activists all over the United States on this issue. I've been involved, I go back to 1979 in terms of Haitian advocacy, and I don't think I've ever seen, the only reason I mention it, I don't think I've ever seen the Haitian-American community nationwide galvanized and outraged as it is at the moment, with the possible exception of the joy that greeted the overthrow of Duvalier in 86. But because what's going on in the Dominican Republic is beyond shameful. So basically what you've got is Haiti and the Dominican Republic share the island of Hispaniola. And going back generations, Haitians have gone into the Dominican Republic to work in the sugarcane fields. And for decades, there's been an issue of what some have called modern-day slavery because of how bad the conditions were. But as you say, going back many, many, even generations, persons have been born of Haitian ethnicity in the Dominican Republic. And it used to be they were considered Dominican citizens. Then, and so the background to all of this also is what some have called, and I'm not an expert on this, but I think this is accurate, what some have called colorism.
Yes.
There's a real, you know, there has been a racist dimension to all of this for a long, long time.
Though, you know what? You bring up a great point, Steve. We've been getting that here in the media. That's definitely been a lot of information that we've been getting. And most of us here in the United States, when we look at the Dominican Republic, we just think that they're just black Latinos. I mean, that's just it. And, it's basically the light shade versus the dark shade. But colorism definitely is something that's at play.
And back in 1937, there was a massacre of Haitians in the Dominican Republic. So there's a long history to all of this. But in the last couple of years and just this summer, things have really come to a head. In 2013, there was a court ruling that basically stripped citizenship from Dominicans of Haitian ethnicity retroactively back to 1929. And there was, of course, outrage at the time. Resolutions passed, letters from U.S. senators, all kinds of things like that. Then, more recently, over the last 2 months or so, the Dominican authorities have been gearing up to physically expel these people from whom citizenship had been stripped. And the Dominican authorities have tried to change the subject by saying this is really about immigration and controlling our borders.
Yes, I definitely have seen that. And those are some of the reports that those of us in the media that we've been receiving, and some of the individuals that are kind of the front for that kind of information, they appear to be tied to their tourism industry, too. That's something that I've discovered.
It's certainly true that there are also Haitian migrants. But that's a separate issue from the over 200,000 people, it's estimated, born in the Dominican Republic.
They were legitimately born there.
Right, who they're trying to expel. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, a law professor I know says it's as if all of a sudden the Obama administration or the court, but assisted by the administration, were to say that all Americans of a certain ethnic background, whether Armenian American or Italian American or Black American or whatever, although born in the United States, all of a sudden we're going to say they're not citizens and then try to expel them.
Yes.
I mean, it's that outrageous. And that's why the community has been so galvanized. And not only the community, there have been editorials in the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Miami Herald and the Boston Globe and op-eds all over the place and articles. 109 U.S. law professors wrote a letter to Obama urging our administration to do much more than it's been doing. On August 7th, 560 former Peace Corps volunteers, each of whom had served at least 2 years, as I understand it, in the Dominican Republic as Peace Corps volunteers, wrote a very strong letter to Secretary of State Kerry saying that we should invoke a certain law called the Leahy Amendment mm-hmm. to strip our military assistance to the government of the Dominican Republic.
Absolutely.
Because of the human rights violation. And one other thing that's really interesting is that the Dominican authorities are incredibly sensitive to the protests and opinion pieces and some urges for boycott. Just as an example, the length to which they seem to be going. When I mentioned a letter by 109 U.S. law professors.
Yes.
When the Dominican embassy learned of this, they not only emailed each law professor a rather innocuous email. They said that the letter they had endorsed was misleading. But they also copied on the email the law school, that professor's law school president or provost or dean in an attempt to intimidate. And
yes.
And that's only one small example. When in June an event was held at which a professor and a leading Dominican author spoke protesting against is happening, they started getting aggressive emails and phone calls and being hung up on. When a Haitian American state senator in Massachusetts urged a boycott, a former diplomat based in up there said, "We will defeat at the polls any U.S. politician who urges such a thing." So they are extremely sensitive. Those are only a few examples.
And now I have a question for you. Someone, when you say a Dominican embassy, not a U.S. embassy, but someone who's Dominican from the Dominican embassy?
Right. They are very concerned to counter the protests they are receiving. They are really sensitive, which is, I think, a sign of weakness and vulnerability.
It is strongly.
They've spent money on PR firms, and a counselor at the Dominican Embassy in Washington to the U.S. Sent these emails. One or more counselors.
My goodness.
But that's only one example. As outrageous as it sounds, there have been a lot of outrageous things that they've been doing to push back. And, of course, they feel vulnerable. Why? Because tourism is very important.
Exactly. And they get 90% of their tourists from the U.S. I know I have been harassed by some of those PR firms, just as a journalist.
Oh, really?
Oh yes. Social media-wise, I just say bring it on, keep doing it, because all they're going to do is they're giving me information to write about.
it's very short-sighted. But there's one thing that we haven't yet mentioned, which is that, and there have been protests all over the United States,
yes,
here in Miami where I'm based, in Washington, D.C., in New York City, and Boston and elsewhere, against what they're doing. But there has been a stunning silence from the Obama administration.
Yes.
And that is, to me personally, the single most troubling thing of all.
Absolutely.
Because if people protest in U.S. cities against what's happening in the Dominican Republic, and the DR authorities are concerned to preserve their good name because of the tourism. But if there's one thing that could happen that would get the Dominican authorities to reverse course, it would be high-level engagement from the White House and from Secretary of State Kerry. And just as an example, on July 14th, the city of North Miami passed a resolution, and I just want to read the two relevant clauses.
Oh, please.
Because they're so strong. If I may.
Please do.
One of the resolved clauses says, after laying out all that is going on in the Dominican Republic, the mayor and city council condemn as shameful and unworthy of American history and values the silence to date of the Obama administration in the face of these historic and ongoing violations. And then it goes on in the next clause, the mayor and city council urge the Obama administration, specifically President Obama and Secretary of State John Kerry, to immediately use and prioritize using all of their political and economic power, leverage, and influence involving trade and many other points of leverage and persuasion, both publicly and privately,
absolutely,
to get the government of the Dominican Republic to immediately and fully reverse course, stop these violations, and restore and guarantee fully and in their entirety the human and civil rights of all of its citizens, residents, and migrants. So the basic idea is there's been a stunning silence at the high level here. We have our ambassador to the Dominican Republic is somebody who raised a lot of money for the Democrats, but
they're not doing anything.
Isn't really doing much of anything.
You bring up an excellent point in terms of politicians being involved, and the thing that you brought up about the individual from the Dominican embassy, a Dominican, threatening local politicians or any politician in the United States that if they do something, not only is that weak, that's a lot of nerve. That's a whole lot of nerve to think that the American public is okay with what they're doing down there. But the point, the silence about the Obama administration you bring up is, it is astounding. I'm actually floored that there hasn't been a peep about it, because I think the administration's silence is what's driving media, basically the corporate media, as well as just how information about what's going on in the Dominican Republic, how it's not being filtered. And and I'm also not only am I floored by the Obama administration, but I'm also floored that the Congressional Black Caucus has been silent as well. And interesting enough, some of the early politicians that spoke out first, just based on my media tracking, I think Mayor de Blasio, he has been very vocal from the beginning. He didn't wait for any prompts. He had his own press conference. And I think a lot of that has to do with because of he has a very large Dominican presence there in New York, Washington Heights. And what's been great, too, is that there has been a lot of great support here in the U.S. and definitely in the New York area. That's where a lot of the first protests, and it's obvious, those of us in the media, we have been watching Miami for sure. And I think also the only other, I think the highest level official that's really put words out has been presidential candidate Martin O'Malley, where he's done, he's a former governor of Maryland. He's actually done some op-eds. And then I think North Miami Councilman Alex Duceme, he definitely has been very vocal and very, I think, accessible to the media in terms of what's going on. Now, can you tell my listeners about, I think your organization had a hand in finally getting some traction in the U.S. Senate. There were 7 U.S. senators that actually put together a letter for John Kerry, Secretary of State Kerry, to get involved.
Yeah, I actually don't think that my organization was involved with that letter, and it's an indication of how widespread both the knowledge and the concern and outrage is about this. We were involved in some other things, such as the City of North Miami resolution, and and we are we have a wonderful page on our website. There's actually been lots and lots of articles and things on this, and I'd urge anyone interested to Google IJDH DR, capitals for Dominican Republic, IJDH DR citizenship crisis, and you'll come up with our webpage at the towards the top of which are all the events that have been going on all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
But following that are probably over 200 different news articles and letters and resolutions, et cetera, about all of this, including, for example, the 560 Peace Corps. I mean, I've been doing advocacy for a long time, but 560 people endorsing a letter. That's pretty strong.
That's the largest.
It's a very strong letter, too. It calls on the Obama administration to basically cut off military ties and assistance based on. And this letter that you mentioned from the 7 U.S. senators notes that, look, to Secretary Kerry, the DR simply needs to, we need to make sure to do all we can. It's sort of a diplomatically worded letter, but, between the diplomatic language, it's a strong letter saying that Kerry needs to use our U.S. Influence to do much better. And just to go back for a moment, I just want to be clear about what the DR seems to be doing. I mentioned the letter from the 109 law school profs.
Right.
That is what I know did get from the information that I've received from some of these professors, emails from somebody at the Dominican embassy.
Yes.
The pushback up in Boston regarding an elected official who is urging a boycott was from I think it may have been a former diplomat, Dominican diplomat. So I don't know, I'm not sure whether he has an official tie to the Dominican government right now or not.
Or that they are a citizen.
It does seem well orchestrated. That does seem very well. The things that the pushback, as I call it, has been rather aggressive, I'm not saying illegal. I don't know that. But it's been rather aggressive, and including emails and phone calls and things like this that has, to a number of people who have spoken up about it. But getting back to the main point, it is rather shameful and amazing that high-level U.S. engagement has not so far been forthcoming. Whether it's privately done or publicly done, one would think that Obama getting on the phone with the President of the Dominican Republic or Kerry, and not just sort of saying we're concerned, but saying, look, you need to reverse course here.
Exactly.
I mean, what's going on is egregious enough, blatant enough, outrageous enough that it requires strong actions by the U.S.
Absolutely. And just in closing, what I want to do, a lot of the, for our listeners, a lot of the points that Mr. Forrester shared today, I'm definitely going to have on our Facebook page. And Stephen, what I'd like to do is also share with our listeners your group's social media imprint. I have your Twitter. Your Twitter handle is at IJDH. And then also your website is IJDH.org. And definitely we will put a lot of these, the links to the letters that you talked about, because I think that's important for our listeners. And also one letter that I did see from your website, and it's, I think it's based on the collective, the groups that are part of the Haitian America diaspora. They actually wrote a letter to the Dominican Republic President Danilo Medina. And I've researched that. And as of to date, they haven't received a response from him. That information, I definitely want to put that on for our viewers. And certainly, I want to thank you so much for joining us. I know back east, it's kind of late in the day for you, but
not a problem. Let me mention one thing before we finish, I may, which I forgot to mention on the DR. You know, the fear and intimidation of trying to deport these people has resulted in, depending what figures you go by, something like 40 to 60,000. I saw a recent report just Friday evening that there are patrols that are now going to round up people to deport them. And the fear is such that a lot of people, about 60,000 according to the report I just read, have self-deported. And so this is very real. And it's also incredibly destabilizing. We've touched on how outrageous it is to strip someone of citizenship and expel them. But Haiti doesn't need an influx of thousands of people. It's trying to recover from all kinds of its own issues, whether it's poverty or instability or cholera. And it doesn't need such an influx. But I really want to thank you and urge any listener to, I know this sounds self-serving or
no,
silly,
not at all. Promote.
But I'm really, really thrilled with the group that I'm with. IJDH is a spectacular, it's a really wonderful nonprofit doing really good work. So anybody interested in any of the subjects we've talked about, just look us up on the web and be in touch.
We will, and thank you with that. And definitely I'll be in touch, and we're going to have to bring you back for sure. But thank you so much, Stephen Forrester, from IDH. IJDH. The Institute. The Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. Thank you so much. And
Thank
listeners,
you.
check the show site. I'll have all of the websites, their social media imprint. Get involved and certainly get social with me and have a great Sunday. And as the day closes, I want you to think about what can you do to be involved in the process. This is the Janet Foster Show, the show that gets action. So please have a wonderful day and have a wonderful week. And we'll be right back here, same time next week. Thank you.